The theater, the theater. Bring out Louis!
Theater, theater.
To be or not to be.
Theater, theater.
Yo.
Hey there, y'all.
Hey there, y'all. Dare y'all sounds like a...
Y'all like Christmas Story?
I love the Christmas Story.
Oh, yeah, I mean, there's definitely some problematic moments, but I do love that. I have to watch it at least once a year.
Yeah.
I haven't seen it in a while, but I know there was a sequel that came. I know there's like a Christmas Story 2 that's not canon or whatever, but there's a Christmas Story or something like that that came out on HBO.
Huh.
Yeah. They did a couple of movies based on that dude's other stories that are told in a similar voice. I guess some of them are quite good and enjoyable, but I've never gotten into it.
I always loved that movie.
Yeah, it's so good.
We always, when we were kids, we would watch the 24-hour TBS thing. Like, not all day, but same. We would continually turn back to it. And our parents would be like, "What are you watching? That's stupid." And we'd be like, "No, it's the best movie ever."
We would keep, that was one that would just be on, even if it was on mute, it was just on the whole 24-hour time. Because we were like, yeah, we're watching Christmas Story the whole day. And same with whenever they would do, I think this was also TBS, when they would do the Bond 24 hours of Bond for 22 weeks or some shit.
We
went in on that.
Let's sit
and watch all the Bonds. We watch a lot of TV.
That's what you
did. What else do you do in the Midwest? Siege, you saw a show last night that you enjoyed.
Tell us about it.
Yeah, by the time this episode comes out, it's going to have closed, and it's called Freight: The Five Incarnations of Abel Green by Howard L. Kraft. It was off Broadway in New York, and then this was the West Coast premiere. It was at the Fountain Theater. Had a friend, Sydney Edwards, was in it.
Sydney!
Just her, and then the main guy is basically five one-man shows, and she was in there just helping with moving things around and stuff. But she was a character in and of itself. But anyway, I just, the last couple weeks have kind of been personally difficult for me for various reasons. And I went last night and the show was so good, and it's sold the fuck out through the whole run. And they're not extending because the lead actor is so sought after. Like, he's immediately going to do something else. But it just, it lightened and soothed my heart big time.
Nice.
In a way that I was kind of able to put to bed some of the other shit that had been bugging me for a couple weeks. And I guess I'm just here to say, like, get out there and see shit, y'all. Even if it's forgetting doing it for the theater, for the actors, for the production staff, do it for yourself, because it really helps.
Art heals.
It really fucking does.
Yeah. The only thing I've accomplished this week, really, other than getting my shots, is both of your Christmas presents are here. Yes.
Well, and you saw Saltburn, right?
I did see Saltburn.
You and I need to talk Saltburn, and then we're going to all go see it together to make CJ talk about it.
Yeah, because CJ will be like in it the most. Pam Eberhard and I had a little exchange on Facebook. She really liked it. And now I'm waiting for her to respond. She was like, "I have one writing issue." And I'm like, "What was it? Tell me what it was." But man,
I forced her to see it with me last night. So that's where she
She
said, "I know what the writing thing was, and I disagree with it. So I'll be interested to see what you say."
Okay.
Yeah.
But that was Barry Keoghan, y'all. Barry Keoghan.
I do like him.
God, and you get a lot of hog.
You see a lot of hog.
So much dick. I love it.
And everyone else in that movie, Richard E. Grant, Rosamund Pike, all of them are fucking fantastic in that film.
And the guy who was the lead in Gran Turismo this year is Farley.
Oh, that's him. Okay.
Yeah. He's amazing.
You hate him so much, and then you don't hate him, and then you hate him, and it's horrible.
But then in Gran Turismo, you like love him from moment one, the entire movie.
Oh, cool. Cool. Yeah. He's a presence. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. How you doing, Siege?
I'm doing okay.
Working on stuff?
Sorry, I was just sending a work text.
Oh.
It's still going on. Sorry.
No, who do we need to kill? This is what I'm talking about. Like,
I need to retire. I need to become independently wealthy and retire. That's what I need.
I got my drill. Let's go. Oh, that got dark. I'm sorry. Speaking of theater, welcome to Theater, the theater podcast for theater nerds, made by three theater makers from the LA. Whoa.
K-town,
was that a gunshot?
K-town.
I'm assuming it was a firework.
Lay down, CJ. But... finish the podcast on your belly. Okay.
Oh my God.
We're in LA, people. This is what happened. Theater podcast for theater nerds made by three theater makers from the LA theater scene. I'm Jay Bailey Burcham.
I'm CJ Merriman.
And I'm Scott Leggett.
It's
true.
Yeah.
True. Yeah. yeah. Well, since Pinter wrote this, I had to make sure to throw a pause in there. Each week we get together to discuss, debate, the definition of theater through various lenses.
Lean into
and
it, brah.
This week we're coming back to what we always do at the end of the season. We're doing Shakespeare again, y'all.
Shakespeare.
And normally we have a guest, but this time we've chosen to go at it alone.
Yes.
Go at it alone.
We're going at it alone.
Yeah.
This is our open mouth kissing practice. Enjoy. Over Zoom.
Yeah, I'm real good at it. Real good.
Are you?
Yeah.
Show us. That's nice.
I do a lot of teasing. I do a lot of leaning.
I get that. Oh yeah. Pulling it back.
Yeah.
Going for it, pulling it back. I get you. Well, this week we're beginning our discussion of Shakespeare's problem.
And
problem plays.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10.
Problem plays. How many are there?
Well, okay. So we go down rabbit holes here. So initially there were just three. Okay. Now it seems to be 5 to 6 by the definitions put forward, which we will just talk about in Scottpedia, which shouldn't be confused with the plays that have sort of been listed as problematic,
right?
i.e. Taming of the Shrew, that kind of thing. Arguably, every Shakespeare play has something problematic about it in our modern thing. But yeah, it's a pretty narrow group of plays.
So we're covering Measure for Measure today.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We're covering what next? What's the second one?
Cymbeline.
Yes.
That was
and
my
we're
pick.
Covering Winter's Tale.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Now, we had announced in an earlier episode we were covering, I think, Pericles.
Yes.
Correct.
And we've realized somehow through research that that's not technically considered a problem.
Is that considered a comedy then?
Yes. I think technically it is.
Okay. I mean, it ends happy.
It's a very interesting thing, and it also has to do with the complexity of the folios, how things were ordered by a guy in 1736 who put things in order. You know, that's why we still don't really fully know all of the. We have time periods for stuff, but we don't have exact dates except for playbills, where we know when they were first performed, which isn't necessarily when they were first written. There were definitely a few that he kept around and played around with before he did it, so we don't know. We don't know.
According to the Bill Shakespeare Project, Pericles. It says in this article, A Question of Genre, written in 2017.
Mm-hmm.
It says, is it a tragicomedy or a romance? And what does that even mean? It says, we know what a history is. Pericles ain't one.
Mm-hmm.
We know what a tragedy is. Pericles ain't one either.
Mm-hmm.
We know what a comedy is. Pericles? Maybe, but it doesn't feel right. I'm reading this verbatim. We know what a problem play is. Well, sorta. And Pericles could be one of those, but still. And then it goes on to explain why it might be a tragicomic romance.
Right.
And nothing. And therefore not considered any of the other things.
I see. Right. That's probably why I put it in problem play.
I think it's tough, because it doesn't, it's not dealing with a social issue the way the other problem plays are. And that's part of the definition is
right.
It's sort of addressing those sorts of things.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. So anyway, we're not doing Pericles. Sorry if you read it and you were expecting
us
to
cover. Play.
By the way, I wanted to do a quick shout out while I'm thinking of it, because I will forget by the end of this. A couple of people, including friend of the pod, Austin Almond.
Austin. Love, really. Hi, Austin. Yeah, Austin.
Have sent us their Spotify, what's it called?
Like a year in review type thing, right?
Yeah, their year in review Spotify thing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And we've been like in their top five.
Right on. Spotify, thanks, y'all.
Which is kind of cool. So we appreciate that. And thank you for that.
Yeah. We got shootings going on in K-Town. We got ghosts in Pasadena.
They're cleaning. Cleaning outside my
ghosts
apartment.
Okay. Or cleaning. Yeah.
The ghosts are cleaning. So the ghosts of Pasadena. They do exist. Check my TikTok. So, no, don't. Okay, so it's measure for measure today, but we have something that we always do first.
Yeah.
Beginning of one of these playwrights. And Scott, what is that thing?
Well, it's called
Scottpedia.
Scottpedia. Now, this is the end of our fourth season. I've covered Bill. And weird stuff about Bill. So today we're going to talk. We're going to talk specifically about what the problem plays are, how they're defined, and how this all comes into play as we talk about Mesure for Mesure.
Excited for I know very little about the problem plays. I'll be honest.
Yeah, me too.
Okay, well, here we go. In Shakespeare's studies, the problem plays are plays written by William Shakespeare, which are characterized by their complex and ambiguous tone, which shifts violently, between more straightforward comic material and dark psychological drama. Shakespeare's problem plays eschew the traditional trappings of both comedy and tragedy and are sometimes cited as early predecessors to the tragicomedy. The term problem plays was coined by critic F.S. Boas, B-O-A-S, Boas? Boas?
Boas, I don't know.
In his Shakespeare and his Predecessors, written in 1896. Boas's use of the phrase was derived from a type of drama that was popular at the time of his writing, most commonly associated with the Norwegian playwright, Henrik Ibsen. In these problem plays, the situation you love him. Peer Gant. The situation faced by the protagonist is put forward by the author as a representative instance of a contemporary social problem. The term can refer to the subject matter of the play or to a classification, quote unquote, problem with the plays themselves. According to Boas, Shakespeare's problem plays set out to explore specific moral dilemmas and social problems through their central characters. But they're all over the place. You can't pin them down. So it's sort of those two levels. They're dealing with social issues and questions. And Measure for Measure really does it fucking well. Like, in terms of why and where the conversation came about, the idea of talking about power and virtue and all that kind of stuff. It is an interesting history point, which we'll get to. But then they're all over the place. They shift gears like motherfuckers, you know. Again, probably in an attempt to create a night of talent or a night of entertainment, I should say.
Of joy and glee.
Well, or sadness and pathos.
Oh, yeah, you're right. You're right.
Introspection. Sorry. It could be any of those. You're not wrong.
Catharsis.
Catharsis. Right.
I'm gonna cathart all over the place. Catharted last night. It was awesome. It's really good.
It's really good. Yeah. It's all over the place.
I know I'm having an emotional day when I can when I'm watching something like what I was watching last night, where I bawled my eyes out at the end of Doctor Strange and the Multiverse of Madness. What a fucking idiot.
I cried through the play I saw last night. So
we all need to cry more. Therapy and crying. That's what the world needs.
Yes.
And love and, you know, peace.
Love doesn't exist. It's fine.
Wow.
Well, I don't know about that, but, you know.
It doesn't.
I love my child.
Yeah. It's a chemical thing. There's part of you floating around.
Have you
in
met
your
this
gene.
Child?
I know, she's wonderful. Have you met this child? I actually haven't met the child. I've met her virtually.
Well, that's on
virtually.
You.
Yeah.
You should be calling her all the time to hang out. Let's talk about Measure for Measure.
Okay.
So, real quick.
Yeah.
Let's give context with it real quick from each of us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Or did you have more Scottpedia, Scott?
No, like that was it. Okay, yeah, just talking about that.
Well done. I loved it.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Great job.
Thank you. Thank you, Wikipedia.
Yeah.
And other sources. There were there was like four or five things I went down.
Sure.
Yeah.
The Britannica has some good stuff about Measure.
Britannica always has good stuff. Yeah.
I forgot what I was going to say.
Context
about this play for me is purely that I had never, ever touched it until 2019. I was directing it at Shakespeare Youth Festival.
Oh, wow.
High schoolers.
Wow.
Now, these high schoolers can handle this shit, but we heavily edited it and also... it changed the context of a lot of what was being said, if mm-hmm. that makes sense.
Right.
And it was working and it was very good. And we had actually playing Angelo, we had the son of Diedrich Bader, who you would know from the Drew Carey Show. Napoleon Dynamite.
Commercial with him years ago. With him that never aired.
He's a great dude. But his son was Angelo, which was crazy. And it was a very good production that did not get to perform because we were in Tech Week when COVID. So we shut it down and they never got to perform it, and it was so sad because we had multiple seniors in the cast, and like it was just it was awful. But I knew it very well while working on it.
Mm-hmm.
While reading it, I was having moments maybe because of the cuts or because of the way we were doing it where I was like, I don't remember this.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Whoa. So there were some surprises in here for me. But had y'all read this before?
I personally did Act 1, Scene 3 of this in my Shakespeare class when I was a junior. So I had read the whole thing and had interacted with it. It's the scene when Isabella goes to Claudio and says, hey, sorry, I'm not going to fuck the Duke and you're going to die. And then he's like, oh, but fuck the Duke because I don't want to die.
What if you did, though, man?
I actually have a long story about the experience of doing this scene because I don't want to air out bad laundry on the pod because it was with someone in our class that at this point in conservatory, nobody wanted to be paired with because they were a problematic scene partner. And it ended up being a very stressful situation for me. But also it was one of those moments in conservatory where I tried one of the exercises that we had learned in like movement class or something. And I went and did some personal work on it. And then the next day when I showed up for class, like, bam, there was all this fucking emotion there that hadn't been there before. So it was a cool theater moment, but also stressful. Mm-hmm. And then I did for monologue work in my Shakespeare class, I did the speech that she did right before she goes to see Claudio too, right after the Duke tells her right after Angelo gives her the deal. It's the speech, to whom should I complain? I used that a couple times in college, but I knew it a long, long time ago, but hadn't interacted with it since. And I got to tell you, I was extra tired when I woke up yesterday morning and tried to start this, but I read the first page and I was like, this might as well be in ancient Greek because I don't understand a single fucking word I read, but it got better as I kept up with it.
Yeah.
Scott?
I had read it and hated it in college. Just didn't get it. Like, not hated it. I just was like, oh, this isn't Hamlet. This isn't Lear. This doesn't have the bite. And credit to Dr. Mark Fearnow, who was one of the literary professors in the theater department, whom I never took a class with, but he and I would always kind of like run into each other in the little lounge area in the theater department, have coffee, and he was the one that was like, no, let me tell you why this show is badass. And so by the time that was done, and then the year after I left Penn State, they did a production of it, which I went back and saw, and it was good. Like, and some of my friends who were in it were good. My friend Andrew Heffernan, who's here in LA and who was at Fringe recently this year, was Angelo and was quite good in it. And yeah, but that was it. I had done the scene. I had done both the Angelo and the Claudio scene. And which is to kind of, we'll get into it, but one of the things that I admire the most about this play, and I kind of sat down and zenned out and read it in two sections. I watched some of a bad production on YouTube, not to disparage anybody, but you got to go fast, people. Got to pick up them cues, especially at the top of a Shakespeare. There's no, you just, let's get to it. And so we can get to the meat. But it was a lot of that kind of stuff, but really kind of sunk into it. And I think this time sort of looking through a modern lens of Me Too and the idea of grooming and all that, I was struck with how much room Bill gives people to play around. For instance, that scene with Angelo when she comes in, is she... Cause he's kind of he's not just dropping hints. Like he's luring her in, and she either is so innocent and pure that she doesn't recognize it, or she's fucking with him until he finally comes and blurts it out. But you have this wiggle room with her, and also that her piety is also a fetish. She fetishizes her
well, and it's interesting because the thing that I pulled from this was fetishization of things that don't want to fucking be fetishized.
Well,
like her chastity and purity and virginity. But yeah, you're totally right. It depends on the performers and it depends on the director, like how this is
done.
Have
you all seen Benedetta?
The
Paul Verhoeven of Showgirls fame? Okay, well, we're going to watch that all together and cover it someday because it just has to do with everything we're talking about. And I'll just say that. That's all.
Yeah. But yeah, that was really my only experience. I think I saw a production at Boston Court a few years back.
That's a place to see it here in LA.
Boston Court.
Did a production of it that they might have done before, but they just did a production that's an immersive version, that's like a meta immersive version, and it's called Measure Still for Measure or something like that.
It must have been A Noise Within then.
Okay, but they just did this in the last
Boston Court did
few months. Yeah.
Okay.
Apparently it was great.
Yeah.
Hannah Trujillo was telling me it was awesome. She works there now, and she was saying it was great.
Oh, Hannah Trujillo. Yeah. She's great.
Do y'all want to know what happens?
Yeah.
Yeah. I think what we all need right now is a good CJ breakdown.
I don't know if you want that.
Well.
CJ's breakdown. This is a good one, you guys.
Okay.
The Duke is headed out for an undisclosed reason and leaves his Weasley right-hand man, Angelo, in charge. Who immediately comes down hard on premarital gushers, particularly men. Claudio, who has gotten his fiancée Juliet knocked up pre-hitching, is arrested and sentenced to death. Claudio sends his almost nunified sister, Isabella, to the stand-in Duke to plead for his life, which evidently gives Angelo a mad boner. He'll release Claudio, dot, 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 if Isabella bangs him. Ew, gross. What's a gal to do? Save her brother and foul up her soul eternally? Don't worry, y'all. The actual Duke is in disguise as a friar this whole time and has a master plan. Yeah. I'm proud of that one.
No,
I was giggling while I was writing it down the whole time.
Very
it is, and I think you nailed why it's a problem play, because there's so much wackiness and disguise and subterfuge.
And that's only a percentage of the wackiness and disguise.
Right, exactly, you know. But then, like, it's just weird as you pull back the layers. For example, I had always thought of the Duke as as a noble character. He's going to observe, he's going to step back, he's going to try and place Angelo in charge to help clean things up. But then you're like, well, why is he doing that? Well, because he's kind of a turd in that he wants to be liked. That's what he wants. He wants to be liked. That's why things have started to go awry, because he was easy on shit. So then then he puts real super turd burglar in charge, Angelo. Right. And then he goes under disguise and he does so many things that end up being kind of fucked up. So he gets that moment
like
alone.
Undercover Boss. Do you ever
watch
Undercover
Boss? Yeah, like Undercover Boss.
It's kind of fucked
up. It's exactly what it is. It's like the billionaire's like listening to the employees go, fuck that dude in his ass. And fuck his yacht, too.
Yeah,
But like he ends up, so Isabella can't be alone with any man.
Right.
But she ends up being alone multiple times.
Well, she can because she's not quite a nun yet. They say that in her first scene.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
But then he tricks the what's her name, the older nun, to split so that he can have that moment with her at the end where he drops the whole fucking plan on her. But she loses her voice throughout this thing is what I found. She loses agency. She knows exactly where she is at the end. Then she's manipulated, twisted, stabbed in the back by all these men, and manipulated to do these things to the point where at the end she's almost quiet in a way that she isn't before, because the one thing she has is her virtue, but what's that worth now? And now the Duke's just asked me to marry him. Oh.
Well, the one thing that the couple like summaries and shit that I read while I was going through this, that they made a point of at the end of it, the Duke asks her to marry him, but she never answers him.
That's right.
No, so, that's the, you know, which I think is the point of the play. The point of Bill writing this is so that everybody goes, that they're walking out talking about it. He's not going to give you the answer. And that comes out of, this is my interesting fact, and then we'll move on. So while this is being written, the Church of England's on its rise. Elizabeth earlier in her life has declared that England is now Church of England. And so what Church of England's trying to do, especially in its early days, is walk the line between Catholicism and Protestant Reformation. Like, so you're allowed to pray to some saints and deities, but we're gonna keep it chill. And so these questions arise out of that period. Like, it's a period of real theological debate that's going on in Shakespeare's time in terms of what is mercy? Can one be accountable for someone else's ultimate destiny, I guess? Whether that's secular or whether that's earthly or divine, and so the whole, I think that's why it feels fucking scattered as shit. And at the end, he's like, "What do you think, huh?" Blackout. Like, that's my.
It gives us all the ability as creators to do whatever the fuck we want. At the end, which rules.
I agree. Yeah,
and you know, especially as Shakespeare Youth Fest. They, you know, the kids get to sort of create the concept or the reconceptualization of whatever show we do. And their whole thing was like, well, she's obviously going to say no. And I'm like, well, if we can't add dialogue, how do you do that? And they were like, We just show it. Just have her
she
turn
flips
it down.
The she double
just,
bird like, and walks up.
Takes her head and she leaves and she, you know, or something. And I was like, okay, interesting. We played with it for a long time. I don't even really remember what we ended up doing, but it was powerful. And I think it's just it's an exciting play for that reason as a creator.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it also, because we're talking Shakespeare and it always gets academic, you know.
Yeah.
I think there's a. This is like one of the most debated plays
for sure,
maybe of all time, right? And everyone has debated whether or not this is feminist, whether or not this is, you know, is this Isabella's story, is this Angelo's story, whose story is this really, what is it, what is, thematically what is it really trying to say? If it's a dark comedy, then is it on anybody's side? And it's an interesting piece because he doesn't do a lot of ambiguity.
It's true. It's
right?
true.
That's what we know him for as being.
Yeah, you know. And especially in the masterpieces and the big ones, he sort of sticks his endings pretty, usually pretty clearly. Henry the Sixth, Part One, not so much. But he sticks the landings. And here, again, I think we go back to this idea where he's asking himself a lot of questions because, you know, we know that he was a fairly faithful person, but we don't know what degree, and certainly hanging around with actors and stuff who are the low end of, you know, or viewed as the low end of the moral part of society.
Yeah. Fuck actors.
Yeah. Right. He's, you know, he's
except
in this
Mary
sort
Louise
of unique
Parker.
Position, except Mary Louise Parker.
Oh no, I would fuck Mary Louise Parker.
No, stop it. Can I just point
I'm
out
kidding.
Two things that kind of kept hitting me between the eyes while I was reading this was the time-honored tale. Something that I think relates it to today is the idea of people in power putting impossible standards on people they govern that they themselves are probably guilty of 100 times more.
Girl.
The fact that, that Angelo is putting these impossible standards on these people that have always been living their lives this way. That, like, the first chance he gets with a woman that is completely disinterested in him, he's like, I want to get in your pants.
Right.
But the other thing that I thought was impressive, take a breath, CJ, incredibly progressive, maybe it's just because I'm thinking way too much in post-Roe v. Wade bullshit, but the fact that the person that gets in trouble for fornication is the man, and he is put in jail and put to death. But this whole time with Juliet, they're like, give her a place to stay and make sure she's taken care of. And I'm like, that's amazing to
but
me.
Is that well, agreed.
You know? No, just kidding.
Well, and then to your first point, and the fact that Angelo falls for her because he gets horny about her piety. Like, he gets horny about her chastity. She's hot. They keep describing her as being hot. You can have whatever you want. You don't need to be in a nunnery because you're pretty hot, which is, you know, fascinating.
Why doesn't she just become a model?
Right. I just want to see this version with a lot of upspeak. But then he turns around and he catches himself. He recognizes that he's going down this dark path and then goes, yeah, I'm going to go down this dark path. I'm in charge.
I can fucking do it.
I'm going to do it. Like, so.
Absolute power corrupts kind of thing.
Absolutely. You know? Yeah. Just,
he's a Sith.
You know, but this is kind of gray Shakespeare, isn't it?
Sure.
It's sort of in between. It's the ambiguity. It's the meditation on hypocrisy. And then the necessity for mercy, especially mercy for these sort of these made up fucking dumbass fucking religious rules, you know, what's law, what's the church, and this time there is no difference. It's the same fucking thing. But that's the thing I think that makes Angelo so interesting is that his talking about it, trying to figure it out, like if he's, you know, if he's still good in his mind by his definition of good, as he goes on. But he gets his.
And then kind of doesn't. I mean, I don't know.
Well, you're right. He has to.
That's why it's a problem play.
He has to marry. That's why it's a problem play.
Problematic play.
Problematic play.
Did y'all know that this, much like many of Shakespeare's stories, plays, this is based on other stories, based on other
I was
works.
Curious which one it was based on, what thing it was
based
on.
Oh, it's the same source material that was Othello, wasn't it? Am I wrong?
Maybe. That sounds, I don't know that. I do know it's based on two stories that were written pretty recently before this. Like, they're not, like, super old plays that had been written, but there's a story from Epitia, which is a tragedy by Italian dramatist Giambattista Giraldi, who was also known as Cinthio.
Cinthio.
S-I-N-T-H-I-O? C-I-N-T-H-I-O.
Yeah.
Cinthio. Or Cinthio, I don't know. And there's also another play by George Whetstone from 1578. So that's only like 25 Whetstone. Years before the Whetstone. It's called Promos and Cassandra.
Okay.
So I guess it was just, I assume that's Angelo and Isabella. I don't know. Or maybe it's Claudio or I don't know. And Juliet. I don't know what the title is referencing, but kind of interesting. It just, you know, we know that all of his stories are recycled stories, and these are just, it's that we're really studying him because of the way he wrote and the time that he was writing and, the, you know, all these things. But it's always a little jarring when you read that. You're like, oh, right.
He did,
he's not
yeah.
the originator of most of these stories. What are we,
no,
of course.
No, yeah.
Yeah. He'd be and how a many great of them writer have for a... Marvel.
Yeah.
For the MCU.
They could
yeah,
use
he
him.
He would adapt the old comics perfectly, and it would be awesome.
I kept giggling to myself because I kept thinking about, while reading this, when we were watching White Christmas, all of the jokes made about 1950s VD.
Yeah.
And there's so many jokes about VD in this play.
Oh,
and
for sure.
I just, like, for how bad 1950s VD must have been, can
VD
you imagine Elizabethan VD?
1604 VD?
VD like, and ED are always funny. Right?
Right? Now, well, wait, erectile always. Dysfunction or eating disorder? Actually, I think both of those
erectile.
Are funny as fuck.
No, they're not. Erectile is the one listen, that's funny. Erectile
eating disorders are hilarious.
Well,
I get always. To say that.
I guess you do.
Sure. I don't know who gets to say it, but if it's anyone, sure. I also think we should discuss the fact that this is a play that a lot of people probably hate. Mm. Like, Scott, you read it and you really hated it when you first read it.
Yeah, or just, you
a
know.
A lot of times when you say Measure for Measure, people either go, ooh, whoa, yeah, that one. Or they go, ugh, oh, I hate that play so much. And I think it is the gender politics at play, right? I would assume.
I think that that's part of it. I mean, I didn't have any problem pointing to the men in this going, the men are the problem here.
Yeah,
I
mean,
wonder if people just assume it's because of the time it was written. I think there's an assumption that it's not feminist. Like, there's no way it could be. Not that I'm saying it is. It's just...
Yes, I get that, and the whole like chastity and purity thing with women. I guess I was trying to give it some leeway because part of me is like, I guess again, 2023 goggles on. I was trying to fadge out how this show works, and I thought like another message you can do with this is like just let people live their fucking lives. If people want to like, you know, be open sexually and do whatever, so long as it's consensual, go for it. Leave them the fuck alone. But also, if people don't want to fucking have sex and that's important to them, leave them the fuck alone. Like, I don't know.
Other people's sex life is not your...
It's not none of your business. You don't get to tell them what to do. You don't get to decide what happens to them afterwards, you know?
No matter how much power you've been given societally. And if we want to point that back towards like Roe v. Wade, as you said. CJ,
sure.
It is prescient. It's interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think that that's one of the kind of sub themes of the play is shame, is this idea of shame and the fear of shame, the fear of being shamed, the fear of being kicked off the pedestal. And and how artificial that is and how dumb that is. I think that I would love to see, I'm sure there have been, I'm just not aware of them, but I would love to see just a really great female identifying director like go to town on this, like just go berserk on it. And in terms of placing it, you can place it anywhere and all that kind of stuff.
Right. Because I mean, like, I personally don't agree with the whole chastity thing with religion or something, but I guess something that kind of endeared me to Isabel at the beginning is when she's talking to the nun before she first meets with Lucio. The nun's like laying out the rules for her, and she's like, "Is that all?" And the nun's like, "You're kind of," I don't know what she says, but Isabel is like, "No, I think I'm being given a lot and I would like it to be harder." And it's like, I don't want to be a nun, but respect. Like, she's serious about it and she really cares about it and it's what she wants to do with her life. So, like, you know, I was behind her for that, but, you know, I get it where people think it's a little.
Right. Or a lot, because
anti-feminist.
But see, the choice that she's trying to make is to separate herself, extract herself from the world and from being around men, because that's the crippling, stifling thing. Mm-hmm. And in this little world, in a nunnery, in a convent, amongst other women, she can be herself and maybe enjoy some power. And
if I was directing the movie, I would use "This is a man's world" in the soundtrack.
Hell yeah, man.
Because why not? Yeah. I, speaking of movies of this, there, I just wanted to bring up very quickly, there are a few film adaptations of this. Nothing
I was trying
crazy.
To look if there was anything available.
Yeah, nothing.
There's not, like, much.
There was one in 2020 that was, I think, it has Hugo.
Oh, Hugo Weaving.
Yes.
Yeah, I saw that.
But I didn't watch it. But apparently this is a big show in Australia because there's been a lot of different versions of it, like in Australia and things like they've done it at a lot of like Melbourne theaters, and then the 2020 film is set in contemporary Melbourne, which is crazy.
That.
But so,
and
two...
it isn't Isabella, like, sorry, go on, sounds like
what,
you were
what?
Getting there.
Isn't Isabella,
isn't Isabella like Muslim or something in it? Like,
oh,
I thought
I don't
that's
know.
What I read. I could be completely wrong.
Yeah,
like, they were trying to like make
it
work just... with her, you
interesting
know, yeah.
Interesting. I mean, I'll probably check it out, because in a modern day sense, I think, yeah, it's interesting to take it outside of Christianity too a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, I'm sure Angelo is still Christian in that scenario, but we'll figure that out.
As he should be.
Yes, he should be. The two that I thought were really interesting, though, were there was a 1994 TV adaptation for BBC.
Mm. Okay.
Tom Wilkinson.
Uh-huh.
Is in it, and I
as
believe
the Duke.
I think he's the Duke.
The Duke.
I think he's the Duke. I watched it, and I don't remember if he's the Duke or Angelo. He's one of the two. But I watched it in 2020 when I was directing this, or in 2019. So, you know, it's been a while. But all I remember is, like, the set is really cool, and they do this thing where the opening of the play is Vincentio, the Duke, sitting, which I think it is. I think it is Tom Wilkinson. And he's sitting in this giant chair, and he has like 12 huge TV screens all attached to each other in front of him. And it's all playing all these things happening in the world. It's the news. Some of it is like him like spying on banks and people and all this stuff. But he's like watching the world, that his kingdom, quote unquote, his dukedom, his whatever, his land. And he's like, that's when he does the monologue of, like, you know, like, everything's bad, you know.
Uh-huh.
And it really worked, like, in a modern sense. And I thought it was really, really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it makes you really hate the Duke. It makes you feel like he's like a big brother type.
Mm.
And then he's like
that
spying on people the whole time. And he's doing all this extra. It's really, it's interesting.
Which he kind of is with the whole disguise thing too. So, yeah.
Well, and we brought up Undercover Boss, and I've
but that's
always thought
really
that,
good.
Right?
Perfect.
I've always thought of that show as being a little morally unsound.
Sure.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Like,
there's
there's
a piece of it. And, you know, they have cameras on them and stuff. So they're aware that they're being filmed, right? It's not like it's all hidden camera, or maybe it is hidden camera. But it's like things like that, or like even Restaurant Impossible, or those things where they're filming them and they send in fake people and they do all this stuff to kind of catch them and shit. Yes, no one should be acting the way those people are acting, and that's awful. But that, like, sort of like, I'm going to trick you into fucking up kind of thing. And the undercover boss thing, I know sometimes it's really emotional and that's why people really loved the show and it really lasted. But a lot of the time it would be like, cool, like, I haven't learned anything but that my employees suck. And you're like, no,
I'm firing Gary.
Which is not the point. Yeah.
Anyway, I thought that was really interesting. You should check it out if you all get a chance. It's on YouTube. It's just the 1994. I think it's on YouTube. Actually, I don't know. And then in 2015, this is weird and interesting. There's a movie called M for M.
I think I vaguely remember that.
Yeah, and it's, what if Isabella's character was a male, and so it became more of a homosexual discussion in the play, and less about, you know, chastity in the sense of being a nun, and more of in the way of not, I don't know. I don't.
Well,
really,
and I was trying to think of ways that you could do this now. Interesting ways that you could do this play. And I thought, A, you could do a straight up farce over it. Or B, I thought, and we can cut this if it's not a good idea, but I was thinking somewhere along the lines of like almost a queer retelling of it. Like, what if Isabella is asexual, or you're forcing them into something that like, that is outside of their sexuality. You know what I mean?
That's interesting.
Really. And I think it makes me think that this adapts to modern times easier than a lot of other plays.
Exactly.
A lot of other plays, you gotta force, you know, round pegs into square holes in order to make it work.
Yeah.
But this, you really
Especially could
could tweak with this just enough because it kind of works wherever. You basically just need a metropolitan area where shit's a little crazy.
Yeah.
You could do it in the East Village. You could do it in downtown LA. You could do it any number of places. Yeah. I watched part of a version that was set in New Orleans at the turn of the century. Mm-hmm. So, you know, just a lot of, you know, fucked up shit going on. So you could play it that way. But in terms of a modern place, why not put it in modern Melbourne?
Yeah.
You know, and
pretty cool.
Melbourne. Heartbreak looks pretty good in a place like this.
Heartbreak feels good in a place like this.
I think that's a great idea, CJ. You can put all those filters through it because, again, I think that because of the ambiguity that he's intentionally trying to balance on is, you know, and that it's a play about asking questions and sort of posing these moral conundrums and ethical conundrums. And then putting it through a really cool little personal filter. All these characters are quite good. And as we talked about early on, like, you can make a lot of bold choice. Claudio could be, you know, a swaggering jackass, you know, but he could also be just a real serious dude who just,
I mean, all he did was fuck his fiance. Like,
well, he got her pregnant, which I think is why she's allowed to get away with it.
But it's not like he was out, like, you know, some of these characters are out gallivanting.
No,
quite
absolutely.
A bit.
Absolutely.
And he was planning on marrying her. I mean, morally, comparatively, even though I don't believe in that bullshit, I mean, he wasn't really that bad of a.
I think that's what Lucio. And those characters.
Lucio's fun.
Lucio's fun, but they're that side of the argument. They're like, yeah, dude, we're gonna fuck around. I'm gonna fuck and do
I get
what
women
I want.
Pregnant all the time.
You know, and you know, watch out for yourself. Be careful, but you know, but your piety and your, you know, theocracy isn't helping. Things aren't getting any better.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And then you've got what's his name, Barnadine.
Yeah, Barnadine drunk all the time.
He's just a drunk murderer, but he won't go along with anything. He won't go along with either side. He's a complete I'm about me. Okay, we're gonna take you to the other room and cut your head off. Nope. I'm gonna stay right here. I'm gonna keep too drinking. Drunk. Yeah, too drunk to get hung. Not today, bro. Talk to you tomorrow. And he keeps going. And then, I mean, he's a murderer. They say he's a murderer. But then he's also let off the hook at the end.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. And he doesn't do anything to earn it, but he's just, but I guess that there's also kind of something poetic because those people exist. Those people that just sort of float through life and get away with shit. And
our last president.
Yeah, but not on that scale. Like, you know, just, you know.
I said our current president. They all suck. But the another piece of this that we have to mention is the rascally underworld. The bod. Yeah.
I love a bod.
We love some bod.
Yeah.
This is where I think this play like gets to have so much fun.
Yes.
I agree. Yeah.
I think CJ was the one that said, you've both kind of like tapped into it a bit. I think farce is a great way to go with this play because maybe not even it's so interesting because it's a problem play. Maybe you lean into the really intense, like these scenes are really serious. And then we get some Mistress Overdone and they're like, like,
yeah, man, fucking lean into
the pressure release. Yeah.
Lean into those curves.
Because Mistress Overdone rules. When we did it, it was one of our performers named Milo in drag
and right on
was hilarious, was absolutely hilarious. We love Pompey. Pimp and Pompey. Yo.
You know,
I'd play Pompey.
We need some, we need, yeah, every show needs
or
some
froth.
Froth. Slightly wacky pimps.
Yeah. Yeah. Like I would play him like Gary Oldman in True Romance.
Yeah.
Like have a Rastafarian accent for some reason.
There you go.
Yeah. No, I would never do that. It'd be canceled. It's fine.
Yeah. No, yeah. I agree. Elbow.
The constable.
God damn. Gotta have a good elbow in there. Fucking
nothing like a good Keystone Cop.
You absolutely gotta have an inept policeman.
Yes.
You know?
Listen, I guess cops have always been bastards. Like,
right?
I was watching an episode of Sesame Street today where a cop showed up in it's the guy who's, if you'll know the Muppet. He's blue and he has like kind of a mustache and he's always kind of like he's the annoyed neighbor or he's the it may be. But it was a Christmas episode and they went back in time and he was this like old constable. Basically, and he's just the wet blanket of Sesame Street. And I was like, of course he is, because he's a cop.
He's a cop. Aw. Yeah.
Sesame Street's great. I just watch it by myself. I wasn't even watching it.
It's a good show.
It's a good show. Good program.
Yeah.
Good program.
Good program. Okay, anything else y'all want to talk about specifically within the play?
Well, I'll just say this. It's the only Shakespeare play its title is drawn directly from the Bible. So.
Oh.
Is that right?
Yeah, Sermon on the Mount. Yeah.
There's no Romeo and Juliet in Exodus?
No.
No? Okay.
No.
All right.
Good to know.
No Hamlet in Genesis?
No.
Is it kind of supposed to be like eye for an eye type of thing? Measure for measure?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, Jesus says it on the Mount. But that's the whole
thing.
No,
but eye for an eye is a very not Jesus thing.
Oh, well,
I'm gonna look up the Sermon on the Mount now. I haven't read it in a while.
Just watch Jodorowsky's Holy Mountain. It's
You'll get it.
You'll get it.
Come on.
Didn't we watch that?
Yeah.
Look at the movie.
She loved it.
That one was good.
Look at your face.
The other one was not good. El Topo. I don't fuck with El Topo. Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Should we do a half hour on Jodorowsky? Is that where we're headed?
Yeah. Jodorowsky's
it's just going to be like, me sighing and rolling my eyes.
I did. Okay. There was. I was. I'll find. I'll shut up after this. My favorite quote and the quote that we all need to remember: "Our doubts are traitors and make us lose the good we oft might win."
Girl.
Doubts. Wow. Yeah.
Listen.
Doubt, a parable.
Listen.
Dirt.
By John Patrick Shanley.
Dirt.
Yeah.
Dirt.
Dirt.
A parable.
A parable.
A parable.
A
I'm sorry, that accent never gets old to me.
But that's all I got.
John Patrick Shanley just sounds like a cartoon, a South Park character.
Yes.
John Patrick Shanley's character.
I gotta say.
My name's GPS and
I read plays.
I love plays.
Reading this, it took me a minute to kind of get my brain back in Shakespeare mode, but I did enjoy the read. And then actually our discussion made me enjoy the play even more, so.
Good play. Nice work. I think it's a good play.
Yeah, it's a play I'll keep an eye out for.
I encourage y'all to maybe give it a little more energy. Yeah. If y'all
there's stuff here. There's some fun stuff here. Yeah.
And if you're not someone who, like, reads Shakespeare, because I'm not. I don't like to read
it's
Shakespeare.
Hard to
I like
read
to
it for me.
See Shakespeare. That's kind of it's kind of what its purpose is. And I think it was like when I was in college and they offered a Shakespeare course, but it did nothing for your theater degree, only for an English degree. And I was like, that should count for both.
That's yeah. Yeah.
But they were like, but it's studying the text. I was like, so
yeah.
It counted. I got to count it. We had to take two dramatic literature classes on top of our theater history classes. And so that was
interesting.
I got to take Shakespeare's. Shakespeare's.
I forgot what I was saying. I don't even think I had a good point. But my point always is that I love you guys.
Love you back. This is fun.
We do good podcasts sometimes. We give good podcasts.
We give good the podcast.
Most times.
Yeah.
Podcast do we want to highlight some, spotlight some LA theater?
Let's do it.
LA Spotlight.
CJ, your show closed that you saw last night, right? So people can't see that. Okay.
I will say, if anyone wants to see my choreography for One Christmas Dance, I'm doing the opening number for the Christmas Cabaret at Loft on Thursday the 14th at 8 o'clock.
Oh, fun.
It's at Loft Ensemble specifically?
Like, yeah.
Like, oh, okay, cool.
But it's like a cabaret type night, so it's like a variety show type thing, but I'm just doing...
Because there's also a place called The Loft. So I don't want people to get confused.
Thank you. Yes, Loft Ensemble in North Hollywood.
Cool. Yay!
Yeah.
Yay.
Love it.
I've got a couple things coming up. Sparkle Bob presents a flailing... Hold on. I messed it up already. A flailing, wassailing tale of jubilation of sorts. It's a puppet play for families. It's cool. It's happening at the Broadwater Black Box. JP, who works at the Plunge.
Oh, yeah.
We're all friends with.
Oh, yeah.
He's poured us all drinks. Is in it. They are in it. And... have done it. This is their second year, third year.
Wow.
Third year of doing it.
I love a Christmas show.
Also, JP is like the best people.
Good people.
Fosh.
Also coming up in the next week or so is a production of She Loves Me by the Conundrum Theater. That's also going to be happening at the Broadwater main stage. Yeah. I'll get you more information and post on that. I'll probably go check out She Loves Me. I haven't seen it.
Y'all know
time.
What She Loves Me is, right?
I don't.
It's the musical of the same source material of You've Got Mail.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Shop Around the Corner.
Around the Corner.
Which is actually originally a Hungarian piece called La, Parfumerie or something, perfuming shop that then became a bookstore in Shop Around the Corner and then becomes You've Got Mail. And You've Got Mail, it's also bookstore.
Yeah,
I see.
It's a charming little story.
Just a funny little thing. The only thing I have is that this is not a theater thing, but it's a theater thing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Interesting. A movie theater thing. I went and saw Saltburn last night, like I said earlier. It is crazy to me that on a Monday night in Los Angeles, every single seat was filled.
Wow.
And it was a very large theater.
Nice.
And it was a very vocal, excited, like pumped to be there audience.
Cool.
And I know there's been a lot of like word of mouth about this film, but it just reminded me of like why I love this place so much, like especially in the film side of things where I was just like, right. Like, this wouldn't happen anywhere else. Like, L.A. is the only place you can go to Burbank and see a movie at 8 or you know, after 8 p.m.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's a full house for a movie that's like kind of art house and weird.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Art house isn't the right word, but it's
it is. It's an art house flick. I mean, in the best possible way. Yeah. I described it as if Harold Pinter microdosed mushrooms and wrote The Talented Mr. Ripley without ever having seen The Talented Mr. Ripley.
Yeah.
It was
mine
just
was
like
what if Pier Paolo Pasolini made a, you know, like a college comedy.
Right.
You know, like God, it's so good. Anyway, go see Saltburn.
Great performances.
Great performances. Barry Keoghan is my new boyfriend. So I want to kiss him. So consensually.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you for joining us for part one of three of our problem plays, and we will be back next week to discuss
Cymbeline.
Which is my pick.
Yes.
Yeah, I like Cymbaline.
I do too.
I'm excited. I mean, I have not read it.
I liked
in
it 16 years ago.
Yeah,
it's been a
long time.
Yeah.
I saw it maybe like 6 years ago in LA. Mm-hmm. That was the last time I engaged with it. And I liked that production. We'll talk about it. Siege?
Do y'all have questions or comments? Please reach out to us via email, Instagram, Facebook, or Twitter. Scott?
Thank you, CJ. A big shout out to Ryan Thomas Johnson, who writes our stingers, as well as our theme song, both of which are way better than your stingers or fucking theme song. I can tell you that fucking much right now. Ryan's also an amazing human being and a good person, all to boot. And then finally, to the award-winning legendary playwright, Harold Pinter, who writes every single one of our episodes, and he doesn't even know it because he's dead. But one day in heaven, Harold Pinter, we're going to buy you a beer.
A thimbleful.
A thimbleful of beer.
Because you're so small, Harold.
Aw.
Can't you tell by his voice? He's like a borrower. Subscriber review, it really does help. We love you guys so much. I love you guys so much.
Love you back so much.
Love you back.
And we'll see you next time.
Yeah.
We come to this place for magic. We come to AMC theaters to laugh, to cry, to play. Because we need that, all of us. That indescribable feeling we get when the lights begin to dim. And we go somewhere we've never been before. Not just entertained, but somehow reborn. Together. Dazzling images on a huge silver screen. Sound that I can feel. Somehow, heartbreak feels good in a place like this. Our heroes feel like the best part of us. And stories feel perfect and powerful. Because here, they are.
Thank
AMC
you, Nicole
theaters,
Kidman.
We make movies better.
Better.
Later, everybody.
That was okay, right?
It was great.
Yeah. The theater.
Theater.